From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. First Lady Melania Trump will be among the speakers at tonight's Republican National Convention. Others include Eric Trump, Tiffany Trump, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and many more politicians, voters, and activists. So far, the convention has featured plenty of praise for the president and warnings of the dark future that Democrats supposedly have in store. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez has been traveling with the president, and he joins us now. And Franco, the RNC has really focused on issues that matter to their base. We're talking gun rights, to supporting the police. We heard from Mark and Patricia McCloskey, the couple that pointed guns at protesters marching by their Missouri home. Here's some of what they had to say.
Whether it's the defunding of police, ending cash bail so criminals can be released back out on the streets the same day to riot again, or encouraging anarchy and chaos on our streets, it seems as if the Democrats no longer view the government's job as protecting honest citizens from criminals, but rather protecting criminals from honest citizens.
Franco, there's a lot to pick apart here, and we should add that the McCloskeys face criminal charges for waving their guns at protesters. But you've been traveling with the president. What's the reaction to this and the first night of the RNC from insiders?
Well, their speaking really resonates with some of the base, a lot of the base. I mean, their arguments, their calls for many of the themes that we've heard in the first day of the convention and we expect to continue to hear about. I mean, their warning of uncontrolled lawlessness, of suburban decay if Biden is elected. Those are things that really resonate with the base. And they're also referring to Democrats as radicals and that want to take away people's guns. And they're obviously fans and supporters of guns and the Second Amendment. So these are issues that they're talking about that have been that we've heard over and over again in just the first 24 hours of the RNC.
Yeah, last night's speakers drove home a lot of what you're saying, that a vote for Joe Biden specifically is a vote for socialism. Let's listen to Tim Scott, the only black Republican in the Senate.
Joe Biden and Kamala Harris want a cultural revolution, a fundamentally different America. If we let them, they will turn our country into a socialist utopia. And history has taught us that path only leads to pain and misery, especially for hardworking people hoping to rise.
Okay, Franco, it's true that Biden is the left party candidate, but he'd hardly call himself a socialist. What's the strategy behind painting Biden this way from the Trump administration?
Yeah, it has been very interesting, you know, and it wasn't just Tim Scott and Nikki Haley. They also had Maximo Alvarez. He was a Florida businessman whose family fled from Cuba. He warned of the dangers of socialism and talked about how he knows what he got very emotional talking about what could happen. And, you know, frankly, as you note, it's kind of a tough argument to make. Even on a good day against Joe Biden, he's not the radical left. He's not an extremist. He's not a socialist. But it is something that the Republican leadership, the president and his campaign have been kind of pushing on Democrats for a while. They had actually kind of planned to make this case against Bernie Sanders, but obviously Bernie's not the candidate. So they had to shift a bit. And they're now kind of adopting and saying Biden is just a puppet for extremists in the party. And that's how Biden doesn't have, you know, the backbone to kind of withstand this shift to socialism.
Another big message, Republicans were eager to point to how the economy was doing before the pandemic. When they have to talk about COVID-19, they praise the president's response. But polls show that most Americans still disapprove of Trump's approach. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is approach. And the Republicans had speaker after speaker making pronouncements that what President Trump did was right and that he helped save lives. The polls show Americans feel otherwise. And the president has been, you know, has come under great fire. And I think it's very clear that he feels that kind of pressure. Since the spring, he has been pushing to get things back to normal, pushing governors to get things back to normal. And that push, a lot of health experts feel, was too much and too fast. And now we're still dealing with a lot of these issues, including whether kids should be going back to schools. Many schools are closing and trying to open. And, you know, just things are far from normal.
Yeah. There'll be lots of speakers tonight, but with a little bit of time I have with you, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will also deliver a taped address from Israel. Secretary of States in the past have really tried to avoid any sign of partisan involvement, skipping conventions entirely. What do you make of this?
Yeah, it is unusual. A lot of questions about him talking about Trump's foreign policy on this speech. It appears to violate State Department guidance prohibiting politics and official travel. You know, former secretaries of state did do this, Madeleine Albright, but it was when they were not in a State Department job. And this is a taxpayer-funded trip.
That's NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So a busy week for politicians, but also for weather forecasters. Tropical storm Laura intensified into a hurricane this morning as it spins toward the Gulf Coast. People in parts of Texas and Louisiana have been ordered to evacuate. And it was a close call with Tropical Storm Marco, which has been downgraded to a tropical depression. Marco made landfall yesterday near the mouth of the Mississippi River, dumping heavy rain. Jeff Huffman is director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, welcome back. It has been a busy week for people who follow the weather. What's happening now with Laura? What's the latest?
Yeah, good afternoon, Peter. Laura is a significant threat to the upper coast, upper southeast coast of Texas, southwestern Louisiana. It is entering an environment over the Gulf of Mexico that is ripe for intensification and possibly rapid intensification. So this will be likely a significant landfall of a major hurricane. That's the official forecast from the National Hurricane Center about 36 to 48 hours from now. So that would place it about tomorrow night. We're talking about winds possibly up to 115 miles per hour and a life-threatening storm surge stretching anywhere from Houston, Texas to potentially Lake Charles, Louisiana.
I was just going to say, it looks like parts of Houston have been included in that warning. We know this is a city that's prone to flooding, serious flooding at times. How much potential damage are we looking at along the coast?
Well, residents of Houston and all the surrounding areas, especially that experienced the catastrophe from Hurricane Harvey, this is a much different storm. Harvey was mostly a flooding rain threat and inland flooding concern. This is going to potentially bring catastrophic wind damage to portions of the coast where it moves ashore, in addition to life-threatening storm surge. And remember, Houston is still within that margin of error, that cone of uncertainty. Roughly at 36 hours from now, the average forecast airs on the track are about 60 nautical miles. So that places Houston still within the realm of possibility of a direct hit. Also remember, the intensity forecasts this far out are still roughly 10 to 15 miles per hour in terms of the wind speed. So this still could intensify further, and the greater Houston area, and especially the eastern side of that metro area, could take a direct hit from Hurricane Laura.
What about New Orleans, another city that's prone to flooding? You mentioned Louisiana.
Yeah, there's a storm surge watch there, meaning there's not a lot of confidence that there would be life-threatening storm surge, but it is possible because of the long fetch of wind over the water and the direction of that wind moving in. And the water levels are already still pretty elevated from Marco, so some minor storm surge flooding is possible in the greater New Orleans area. But by far, the deeper storm surge, and we're talking potentially 9 to 13 feet, will occur in southwestern Louisiana, west of the intercoastal city.
So your message to people in the path of this storm, how urgent is it?
Well, today is the day to finish preparations. If you're in danger of storm surge, listen to local authorities, get out, evacuate. If you are not told to evacuate, especially considering the ongoing pandemic, and you know your building codes and how strong your home is to withstand the winds, consider staying put. And of course, today's the last day to finish those construction on the home, repairs, any kind of preparations need to be completed today. Tropical storm winds could be arriving in southeast Texas, southwest Louisiana by midday tomorrow.
So this is very serious, but you know, I guess it could have been worse, because just a few days ago, forecasters were worried that two hurricanes could make landfall this week along the Gulf Coast. Luckily, as we said, Marco kind of faded as it made its landfall yesterday, but it did bring a lot of rain. I mean, is this still a dangerous 1-2 punch?
Yes, the impacts from Marco, thankfully, were a little spread further to the east. So residents of southwest Louisiana have experienced very little from Marco. This is now all about Hurricane Laura. It would be the sixth tropical system to make landfall this season already, which would break a record for how early this is occurring. But Laura is a significant threat, far and above all the other storms that we've had this season. This could be a major hurricane at landfall.
Okay, so we're going to keep a close eye on that in the next 24 hours. But what's ahead after that? Do you see anything else out there in the Atlantic that you've got your eye on?
Well, thankfully, the tropics are entering what I would call just a brief lull in activity after Laura makes landfall, but we are still approaching the peak of the season, and conditions are still favorable for multiple storms and potentially strong hurricanes as well this year.
All right, Jeff Huffman, long day ahead for you, director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, thanks very much, and we will keep in touch as this storm, Hurricane Laura, it appears, gets ready to make landfall. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The coronavirus has claimed more than 800,000 lives around the world, but that's only part of the toll. The pandemic has also added gasoline to the global hunger crisis. The Census Bureau reported in late July that 29 million American households sometimes or often didn't have enough to eat in the previous 7 days. And a new report from the humanitarian group CARE says that at the beginning of 2020, 690 million people around the world were undernourished or chronically hungry, but that number could increase by 130 million because of the pandemic. And according to the report, the burden falls disproportionately on women. Tanya Raw is CARE's Director of Global Food and Nutrition Security Advocacy, and she joins us now by Skype. Tanya, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Good to have you. And why has this pandemic had such a profound effect on food security?
There are a number of reasons, Peter. When we look at how governments and other actors are really trying to stop the spread of the pandemic, that has meant, as many of us have experienced personally, that we're facing lockdowns, we're facing limits on our mobility. And in some places, that also then means that markets are closed. People have lost their jobs, so they've lost their livelihoods. And so it's become both a result of losing income and not being able to afford food, but also not being able to access food, as people have not been able to get out to markets on a regular basis to purchase the food that they need.
And your report says that in West and Central Africa, the number of people facing starvation has doubled. In South Africa, food shortages have gone up by 90%. What part of the world are you most concerned about?
It's a challenge around the world. Whether we look here in the United States and we see the growth in the number of people who are relying on food assistance here in the U.S., or as you said, we look at the growing numbers in every region around the world. It's a challenge everywhere, and it's a challenge for all of us to grapple with.
You point out that 6 million Americans have requested food stamps since the early months of the pandemic. Are the safety nets in this country enough?
I think we're seeing safety nets everywhere stretched. It's a challenge when those numbers are going up as quickly as they're going up for anyone to be responding adequately. And we see that particularly for women as they're looking at the additional challenges that their families are facing, whether because they've lost their incomes, whether because their husbands have lost their incomes, or their children are no longer able to rely on school feeding programs. Suddenly, more people are at home. The caregiving burden has gone up. They have restrictions on getting to the market. They have less income to access the food that they need. And so that's increasing pressures on families and particularly on women.
And tell me what that means for their lives.
That means their lives are harder in the most basic sense. Even before the COVID pandemic, women faced a lot of inequality in food systems. They're major players when it comes to working on farms. They're almost half of the agriculture labor force in developing countries. They also are often the primary providers of food within their families. It's often women who do the grocery shopping. Women are also responsible for as much as 90% of food preparation in the household. But we also see that women often eat last and they eat least when there's a crisis. And now that we're looking at the COVID pandemic, that pre-existing inequality is just being exacerbated. We see different policies being put in place, which are well-intentioned to stop the spread of the COVID-19 virus, but they might be impacting women more than men. In a country like Mali, for instance, there's a curfew that's in place, but that curfew applies to the hours that women are usually working in their fields, but not the hours that men are working in their fields.
In all of this predates, to some extent, the virus. The number of people who are severely food insecure around the world has risen nearly 70% in the last 4 years. Again, before the pandemic, what's going on more broadly around the globe?
There's been a growing recognition that our food systems are broken. We are seeing pressures from conflict and the ability of people to access enough nutritious food, we're seeing pressures from climate change. We are also seeing pressures from inequality. And as income inequality grows, that also has an impact on the ability of people to access enough nutritious food. And so those numbers are going up before the pandemic. We see that impacting, again, women more than men before the pandemic. And COVID-19 has simply amplified that.
What are the long-term effects if this doesn't get better?
The long-term effects, sadly, are that we are facing an even longer hunger crisis. In addition to the COVID pandemic, in addition to the economic crisis, we see families that are going to be facing hunger for an even longer amount of time. Some families are having to resort to eating the seeds that they had been holding on to plant for the next season. If you eat those seeds, you obviously can't plant them, which means you don't have a harvest at the end of the growing season. And that simply prolongs that pain. And this really is where we can begin to look at what isn't working in food systems and begin to fix it now. As we're beginning to think about a recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic, making sure that as we're responding, gender is a key part of that response. But as we're also designing a recovery, making sure that gender is also a key part of that recovery.
Tanya Raw, Director of Global Food and Nutrition Security Advocacy for the humanitarian group CARE. We're going to link you up with their study at hereandnow.org. Tanya, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
As fires continue to wreak havoc across California, four major wildfires are also tearing through Colorado. One of them, the Pine Gulch Fire, is the second largest wildfire in state history. It's charred a remote area bigger than the city of Denver. About 100 miles away, the Grizzly Creek Fire has been burning around the scenic Glenwood Canyon for weeks. The fire is more than 40% contained, but the extent of the damage to the canyon is still unknown, and people who love the area are already grieving it. One of them is Glenwood Springs resident Kyle Jones. He spoke to Colorado Public Radio's Stina Sieg about being in the canyon the afternoon the fire started. He was tubing down the Colorado River when he spotted smoke near Interstate 70.
My first thought was, I've seen a lot of burn scars on the median between the two decks going through the canyon, and this was just another roadside fire. But it quickly became apparent that it was much worse than that. It spread to some of the shrub oak in the area and consumed 10-foot tall, 15-foot tall trees about a second apart, just moving right down the median. It was horrifying to watch. The pit in my stomach was heavy. And as we rounded the corner, it jumped underneath the bridge of the upper deck and began to go up the side of the canyon. And within 10 minutes, it was to the top of the canyon and had consumed the entire side of the canyon wall. And the flames were already 20, 25 feet tall. By the time we rounded the next bend in the river and got out of view of the fire, the plume was already hundreds of feet tall. The entire corner of I-70 had been burned. I was definitely choking down tears as we got back to Glenwood. Even with my car being stuck at Grizzly Creek, I was only concerned about the canyon. It just doesn't seem, it seems so much more important what's happening there than any material item. I've been on Facebook for days, refreshing but every minute, it seems like, and it's not, I know it's not healthy, but I've also been going over and watching it from the cross trail off Red Mountain, just because I felt like there were not a lot of updates coming and I wanted to know what was happening by the minute. But when we watched the flames tear over the No Name Ridge and down into No Name, there was, I remember my girlfriend pretty much collapsed, and we both cried watching it from the Red Mountain Trail, because it's just, you're so helpless, and it's just such a integral part of what makes living out here so special. And so to watch it go in a matter of seconds, it was incredible. It's something I couldn't have imagined. There's such special places. I mean, that No Name Trail is like a rainforest almost, especially in the springtime, and the waterfalls that go through there are so beautiful. And so to think that I can't think of another place in Colorado that has that type of ecology. And I'm someone who's finished the 14ers and has hiked extensively in all the ranges and seeks out like more isolated places. And I've never seen any place like that place. And so the fact that it's gone is tough, and it's hard to imagine what it's going to be when it comes back. It just feels like we're not able to help in any way, and it's super frustrating being on the sidelines when our backyard is on fire like this. Well, you know, piano is my therapy, and so yesterday I played quite the nightmare improv on the piano over at the church I play for, and I think I'll be writing some music for myself to deal with my emotions on it. My roommates and I have already talked about being a part of whatever revegetation efforts take place in the canyon, whether it's reseeding or helping mitigate rockfall or whatever. I mean, whatever opportunities that there are available for us to help, I would like to be a part of. It's definitely a loss, and it's very personal, for sure. And I hope people understand how personal that is. And I hope people understand what a great loss this is for the entire state. I mean, it really is. It's such a huge loss.
That's Kyle Jones, an eyewitness to the start of the Grizzly Creek fire in Colorado. He told his story to Colorado Public Radio's Stina Sieg.
You may have noticed that Wall Street is at or near all-time highs, which is kind of strange considering the pandemic and the dismal state of the U.S. economy. Today, though, the story is about one of the key measures of the market's performance. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is dumping three companies out of the index, including one that's been on the list the longest. Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, and he's been watching this. Robin, good to have you.
Hello, Peter.
First of all, the Dow, a group of the 30 largest companies in the U.S. Who's in? Who's out?
Yes, ExxonMobil, Raytheon, and the pharma giant Pfizer are being shown the door, and being welcomed to the club are Salesforce, Honeywell, and Amgen.
Okay, the question is why is the Dow making these changes? And I hear it has something to do with Apple.
Yeah, I think that's the precipitating event. Apple, which is a Dow component, is splitting its stock. I think it's the most valuable company in the United States. It's splitting it in 4-for-1. And in the arcane methodology of the Dow 30, they're chiefly concerned with a company's stock price. So a company with an outsized stock price has outsized ripple on the Dow index. So now you're seeing movement now that Apple is kind of split into four. And this gives the editors of the Dow an opportunity to reassess and say, who do we want in and who do we want out?
Okay, one of those companies that is out, as we said, ExxonMobil, joined the Dow in 1928. At the time, it was Standard Oil of New Jersey. It's also the longest-running member of the Dow until now. That's got to be a blow to the company's prestige, but what does it say, if anything, about the state of the U.S. economy and where the energy industry stacks up?
Exxon's clout is certainly diminished. It's pulling back from capital projects. It's struggling to pay its dividend. And I think this Dow ejection is indicative of the market telling you that we're closer to the peak of fossil fuel than kind of another high. After all, Tesla, right, which is decidedly non-gasoline, not oil, is now worth more than two Exxons. And Tesla is not yet a Dow component, but you have many out there arguing that it should be.
What about the addition of Salesforce? There are people who say, including Andrew Berry in Barron's, he writes there that the Dow should have added Facebook instead of Salesforce. He says that it's much bigger than Salesforce and it's more profitable. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think there are many critics. I mean, Apple was belatedly added to the Dow. You have other players that for years have been watching these old Rust Belt companies be in there while the economy changes. But I think it's important, Peter, to point out that the S&P 500 index, which weighs 500 components according to their market value, is much more of the benchmark that the investing world pays attention to. But I think having said that, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is more likely to lead the nightly news. It's venerable. It's often quoted. So it's really important as a kind of a club of 30 when you see somebody like Salesforce that was only founded in 1999 added and not yet an Amazon or a Google.
Well, to that point, you know, for people who aren't invested in the market, but even those who are listening to this and say, well, who really cares? Why do we care who's in the Dow and who's out?
It's always enlightening to see how a market indicator as venerable as this contorts to adjust to new eras, right? Salesforce was founded, as I said, in 1999. Exxon's history goes back to Standard Oil's formation in 1870. What about Google? What about Facebook? How about Comcast? How about Starbucks? What other auto players should be in there, should be out of there? Why do we still have a tractor company in there? I think these are ongoing questions and ongoing criticisms. But having said that, it's amazing that this index has existed since 1896.
Robin Farzad, thank you so much.
Thank you.
On the hit HBO show Insecure, Kendrick Sampson plays Nathan, the here and gone and back again love interest of Issa, played by Insecure co-creator Issa Rae. Here he is explaining to Issa why he ghosted her, taking off to Houston without a word.
I know how to explain it, but sometimes I get really down and kind of negative, and I just can't talk to people sometimes. And I didn't want to put you through that.
But Kendrick Sampson is also an activist, co-founder of Build Power. He says he's deeply influenced by the work of others like Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors and Dr. Melina Abdullah, co-founder of BLM's Los Angeles chapter. In June, Kendrick joined Dr. Abdullah and other community activists to present to the LA City Council the People's Budget, a plan to reallocate funds from the LAPD to social programs. He told the council about being shot 7 times with foam bullets by LAPD officers at a Black Lives Matter protest. Kendrick Sampson joins us now via Skype as part of our ongoing series, taking a look at how creatives are reflecting this moment in their work. Kendrick, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You co-founded Build Power to provide training for artists and actors and other creatives to use their voices for social change. And I'm really struck by this because history shows us just how crucial artists have been in helping us understand historical moments of the past.
Yeah, we look at, you know, the efforts of Paul Robeson, Harry Belafonte, and Joan Baez, and all these, you know, dope artists back in the day that stood up. I believe wholeheartedly in the saying that we hear a lot in the movement, which is that there is no revolution without art. And I think it's the best form of communication. And it's necessary to utilize it. A lot of the time, art thrives in dark times. And, you know, what do you remember at protest? Do you remember the signs? How do you move culture through TV and film? And obviously, there's the art in the streets. There's the art of communication, the art of rhetoric and such. So I think it's necessary for us to utilize whatever privilege we have, right? Whatever tools and talents to push liberation, to make sure that oppression is dismantled. I saw my sphere of influence being Hollywood and paired with folks that I thought were like Tia Osho and Mike De La Rocha that were doing some really great work. And we decided to work to organize Hollywood to create a culture of liberation as opposed to a culture of oppression, which Hollywood is traditionally.
You know, Kendrick, it seems that we have seen some progress just in the amount of roles, the amount of productions that are headed by people of color. Do you think the industry is at a turning point?
I think what we see right now is capitalism's version of progress.
Say more. What do you mean by that?
I think that oppressive structures, corporations, and such will do the bare minimum in order to give the appearance of progress, right? And so if they can be convinced that their bottom dollar will be hurt, their profit margin will be hurt, or if they can be convinced that their profit margin will be increased, right? It's that type of consideration that leads us to like diversity talks. Of representation by face as opposed to by culture, which is why we're thinking, you know, with Build Power of how to shift the culture in Hollywood towards liberation as opposed to just faces. Now, there has been progress, and I'm not going to downplay the importance of us seeing ourselves, right? Mentally, it is oppressive to not be represented, knowing that you exist in big numbers, mm-hmm. right? but it's the intention behind it a lot of the time at the top, right? When we don't see any board members that are Black, when we don't see any board members that are actually decision makers and green lighters, you know, for example, with Insecure, right? I say it's an activist show and people are like, how's that activist show, right? The way I see it is, it's, you know, activism doesn't necessarily have to be blatant in our narratives. Issa is showing Black people being Black, you know, and that's something that we don't get to see. We either are portrayed as subhuman or superhuman. Culturally, she's giving Black folks an opportunity behind and in front of the scenes at every single level, department heads, producers, production assistants, catering, you know, whoever, right? And she's also making sure we shoot in the communities and pay, you know, vendors, pay local folks to rent their places, clothing lines that are Black owned, brands that are Black owned. So that is where the activism plays into as well, which is something that we really need to change and have a more holistic approach at the way that we're changing things in our industry.
I want to ask you more about showing the totality of the Black experience in Insecure. So this last season, your character, Nathan, took on the topic of mental illness, and it was done in a way that normalizes mental health struggles. How important is this normalizing of something that basically almost everyone in some form has knowledge of or experience with, either themselves or through loved ones or people they know?
Yeah. Most of the time when we, so, and it's part of the Black identity too, right? When you are in an oppressed demographic, right? You don't want to show, because it's survival of the fittest, right? You don't want to show any weakness, any form of weakness, and anything that could be perceived as weakness, which is why you have the strong Black woman stereotype. You have a lot of homophobia. You have no one wanting to talk about mental health, right? Because those things are seen as weaknesses, and they're not. With mental health, you know, you are 16 times more likely to die at the hands of police if you're experiencing a mental health issue because it is criminalized, right? And in our media, it is criminalized. Most of the time when you see narratives about mental health, it's because, oh, they're the serial killer. Obviously, they had some mental health issue. That's why he was in jail, because he's crazy. Oh, so-and-so got out of jail. Don't mess with them. They're crazy. That's the way that we portray it. And people don't want to be associated with that. So they hide their experiences, and that blocks them from chances of being healed.
It's so intersectional. The work that you do as an actor, of course, the work that you do as an activist. In considering a role, do you consider all of these things, the image that you're portraying or you're promoting through your characters?
Yeah. I mean, I consider it with everything, right? And at the end of the day, regardless of all our efforts, we have to participate in some form of some system
it's
that
true.
Might be oppressive. Yeah. I do my best to consider how I'm participating in capitalism. What type of misogyny is present? Is there transphobia? There's so many things to consider, especially in the identity of Blackness. And so if my strategic advantages, right, outweigh the oppressive disadvantages, then I will do my best to take that opportunity. That's even if I have a chance to influence the narrative of a project, or it might afford me the chance to talk about mental health, because a lot of the time media doesn't want to talk to you about it unless you have a project going on that's applicable to it, right? So is that going to be the opportunity, or is it going to afford me the opportunity to put some money into my nonprofit so that I can fund organizing? There's so many different considerations, but I do my best to look at it from all angles.
What's next for you?
What's next for me? Whew, Lord.
I didn't mean for that to be the response, Kendrick.
Oh, Jesus. Well, you know, it's 2020, so I'm pretty overwhelmed right now. I'm not going to lie. I've got projects that are on hold because of COVID-19, artistic endeavors. I also am, you know, raising funds for nonprofit. We have a lot of work to do, It's election season. So I am striving to push forward on my creative work. You know, I've been writing and producing and acting, and then my activism, my liberation efforts to make sure that we come out of this better.
Yeah. Actor and activist Kendrick Sampson. For more on Build Power, you can go to hereandnow.org. Kendrick, thank you so much for this conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The father of Jacob Blake, who was shot by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin on Sunday, says his son is paralyzed from the waist down. The family has been calling for peaceful protests, even as demonstrations over the past two nights have become violent. In Georgia, a case now before that state Supreme Court could have important implications for how police officers are held accountable when they kill someone on duty. The question is how Georgia's Stand Your Ground law applies to law enforcement. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Grant Blankenship has more about the death of Yuri Martin and a warning. This story describes acts of violence.
One day in July of 2017, Helen Gilbert called 911 in Washington County, halfway between Macon and Augusta. She was worried about her brother, Yuri Martin.
And Uncle Sam about here, you know, being out there in all that weather.
It was a blisteringly hot day, and Yuri Martin was on a 30-mile walk from Milledgeville to Sandersville. Helen Gilbert told the dispatcher Martin had a history of mental illness and was well past 50 years old. She wanted someone to find him and help him. But unbeknownst to her, several minutes earlier, someone else had already called 911. Martin's thirst had caused him to stop on the outskirts of the town of Deep Step. There, Cyrus Harris was cutting grass in front of his home when Martin asked to fill the Coke can he'd cut in half to use as a cup with water from Harris's spigot.
He just walked right up in my yard. I don't see a car, I don't see an automobile, and I just told him to get out.
That's Harris on the recording of the emergency call he placed.
And what did he look like?
He was a black man.
Harris, who was white, explained the thirsty man was black. He also described him as, quote, filthy. He said the encounter left him afraid to leave his wife home alone.
Just nasty as he could be.
So when Washington County Sheriff's deputies responded, they were looking for a suspicious person. The 911 calls were evidence presented against Washington County Sheriff's deputies Henry Copeland, Michael Howell, and Rhett Scott, who would eventually face murder charges in Yuri Martin's death. Once the deputies found Martin, he ignored them until one of them deployed a taser to slow him down. He tore the electrical contacts from his body and walked on. Up the road, he was surrounded by all three deputies. And tased again until he was handcuffed. This time, Martin did not get up. Dashboard video taken soon after shows Martin face down in the grass, hands cuffed behind his back, motionless.
We had to tase some. He's a black male. We don't know his name yet. He's acting crazy.
In total, Martin had been tased for over a minute and a half. It was 5 minutes after Deputy Henry Copeland called his superior before anyone realized Martin wasn't breathing.
445 Central. We ain't feeling a pulse right now.
Another 4 minutes or so before CPR was administered by an EMT. Yuri Martin died in the grass on the side of Deep Step Road. In Washington County, parallels were drawn to Martin's death and the killing of other black men by police, like Eric Garner, who died face down on a New York City street. In Martin's case, though, murder charges were brought immediately. The first indictment was tossed on a technicality. In the second, the defense argued in a pretrial hearing the deputies should be immune from prosecution. In late 2019, a Superior Court judge granted that immunity.
Right, and this immunity that they're talking about here is immunity from criminal prosecution based on the fact that you were justifiably acting in self-defense.
That's Mercer University law professor Jim Fleissner. He says Georgia, like a lot of states, has a special law that allows normal citizens to use violence in self-defense.
And it's not unlike the law in Florida that they call the Stand Your Ground law.
It was under Florida's Stand Your Ground law that George Zimmerman was acquitted in the shooting death of Trayvon Martin. Hayward Altman is the Middle Georgia Judicial District Attorney who presented the case against Yuri Martin's killers to both grand juries. He says a Stand Your Ground defense ultimately rests on who started the fight.
You cannot be the initial aggressor and claim self-defense. If you bring the fight to somebody, you can't later on complain that person fought back.
So when the state made their appeal of immunity for the deputies before the Georgia Supreme Court this month, they had this question.
Essentially, were they men under attack? And the state submits that no interpretation of the footage of the last 11 minutes of Yuri Martin's life support that finding.
That's Assistant District Attorney for Georgia's Middle District, Kelly Weathers, before the court. That Yuri Martin was never violent with the deputies is even supported by the writing of the judge who granted the deputies immunity. That's why DA Hayward Altman says should the immunity stand, it would essentially create a special carve-out for law enforcement under Stand Your Ground, allowing them to claim they feared for their safety every time a citizen didn't comply with their orders. Several justices questioned whether compliance was even warranted, given deputies likely didn't suspect Martin of any crime in the first place. Here's Presiding Justice David Namias.
That's a tier one stop, which a citizen has a right to say, go screw yourself, officer, I'm walking away, right?
That is correct, Judge.
D.A. Altman hopes to bring the three former deputies to trial before the end of the year, should the Georgia Supreme Court overturn their immunity from prosecution. The court is expected to hand down its decision in coming months. For Here and Now, I'm Grant Blankenship.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.